Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carl saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes up and down the country. We invite a range of interesting people to come along to tell stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. There was a full house at the Smock Eye Theatre in Dublin when we put on this discussion about media in an age of fake news as part of the recent International Literature Festival Dublin. We were joined by Kevin Donlan, UK editor of Storyful, Luke Capilla, co-founder and managing editor of Dublin Inquirer, Jane Souter from the School of Communications at DCU and director of the Institute for Future Media and Journalism, and Colm McMahon, a journalist with the Irish Independent, to discuss misinformation on social platforms, fact-checking practices, the journalistic compromises made in the name of clickbait, and the problems which occur when readers want to believe the fake news that they see. It was, as you're about to hear, one hell of a discussion. Hi folks, welcome along. Glad to see you all give up a wet day in Slane, Guns N' Roses, to join us here today instead. We're joined here by four very interesting people. A bit of housekeeping first of all. This is Banter number 165. As you heard earlier on, the safety instruction, if there's any emergency, you know where the emergency exits are. We will be talking for about 40, 45 minutes and then we'll be getting some questions from you as well, so please feel free to have the questions ready for then. So, as I say, we're joined here by four great people, starting at the very, very end, fresh off the plane from Nigeria. We have Colm McMahon from the Irish Independent. Next to him, we have Lois Capilla from Dublin Inquirer. Next to Lois, we have Jane Souter from the DCU School of Communications. And finally, last but not least, we're Kevin Donlan from Storyful UK. Please give him a round of applause. It's really funny, like, as I was researching this topic, normally when you're researching a banter topic, it's like, you know, you're digging deep, you know, you're kind of like, you're going, like, really layered in. It's a deep dive into things because a lot of information isn't out there. With fake news, it's like, it just changes every single day. And they, like, I mean, yesterday, Jane, I found an article in the Journal, they're reporting on the Amoric research during the week about, like, trust in the media, and you were quoted left, right, and centre in that. So I said, that was a good kind of starting off point, you know. What I found interesting was, like, I mean, you talked a lot about confirmation bias and, like, I mean, the fact that basically, people believe what they want to believe when it comes to news. And like, it was interesting, kind of, when you went into the comments at the bottom of the article in the Journal, you had that was the proof of the pudding, you know. So can you talk to me a little bit then about like your take on that kind of trust in terms of the media, and also like a definition from you as the academic on the panel about what fake news actually is?
Okay. I never go into the comments on the Journal.
You have to. I was wearing Wellingtons. You had to.
So yeah, okay. Well, maybe if we start with what fake news actually is, there's what it's defined as most generally. There's some debate about it. Is disinformation. So journalists can often put out misinformation. So things, you know, where there's a frame that you might disagree with, or you know, some sort of information. But fake news is actually something that's disinformation. So it's deliberately put out, and it's either done for monetary gain, so to be able to get the clicks and the ad revenue on Google and Facebook, or else it's done for political gain. And we saw a lot of that with Trump and Brexit and so on. So that's what fake news is about. Some of the reasons then why fake news can kind of work, and often actually people don't even call it fake news now because Trump kind of appropriated that, didn't he? You know, and so yeah. Now the New York Times is fake news. So, you know, it's disinformation or whatever. But one of the reasons that it works is because of the declining levels of trust in all sorts of institutions. So, you know, whether it's the church, whether it's the Gardaí, whether it's politicians, journalists, this has been declining over the last couple of decades. And it's declining as people's education has gone up and as deference to institutions has gone down. So it's not necessarily that you'd expect everybody should trust everything in the media all the time. Like, I think, you know, journalists have to earn that trust, and particular publications have to earn that trust. And it's something that's very easy to give away. So there's a lot of research we do with Oxford and so on, where people give away trust through having commercial influence that people can see through, or having political influence that people can see through, or not being transparent, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, there's ways to build it and ways not to. But the way fake news works itself, as you said, is through confirmation bias. So people always like to read things or to interpret things that are going to make them feel that they're right about whatever way it is they're thinking about the world. So successful purveyors of fake news do that. They feed on people's fears, and they try to confirm their biases for them.
I mean, this must be kind of boom time then for someone like Storyful, Kevin, because I mean, your whole business model is about verification. So if it's a case of media is in an age of fake news and like, I mean, the disinformation that Jane talks about, like, talk a little bit about, like, I mean, has Storyful been making out like a bandit in the last couple of years then?
We definitely kind of came in at the right place, right time. Storyful has been gone, I think, over 6 years at this stage, and I've been there for 3 years or 3.5 years. And initially, it was very much about just verifying pieces of video content as they came up online, whether it was YouTube or Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and making sure that the people that said they shot it had shot it, that they owned it, that they were happy for it to appear on Sky News or whatever that evening, and that it was showing something that was accurate, it wasn't manipulated in any way. In recent times, we've started to see more. It's not that this is new, but we've started to kind of look at images as well as tweets, social accounts, and just the whole minefield of potentially fake content that's out there on any given day. An example during the week that was probably a little bit different than what we normally do was obviously the massive story of this week and probably of the year in this part of the world was the bombing in Manchester Arena. There was a huge there was a lot of examples of people sharing fake profiles of victims, sharing images of supposed victims of the bombing, saying, "Please help my friends being caught in this bombing." And, you know, on delving a little, seeing that you're literally seeing examples of people trying to get followers or trying to get attention online by kind of inserting themselves into this story. So there was a huge amount of content, obviously, that came from this story in terms of like people at the concert, but there was also a huge amount of disinformation and people who, for whatever reason, you can kind of speculate on their motivations, but for whatever reason decided this is the opportunity for me to just come in with a fake piece of information.
Right. So like, I mean, I want to turn the call to you in terms of, like, I mean, Ireland. You know, Jane mentioned there, like, I mean, fake news, disinformation in terms of, like, I mean, profit and in terms of kind of political reasons. Like, Kevin talked there about attention. Have we seen kind of like fake news in Ireland? And what's been the kind of motivation have you seen behind it?
I think that in terms of Ireland, we're probably not at the level, certainly not at Britain and definitely not at the US in terms of fake news. We're probably at a very early stage. We have seen some websites that will put out information that would appear to fit in with Jane's definition of fake news. What we do see a lot more is a kind of a social media fake news, and particularly Facebook, really, in this instance. And, you know, it comes back to the old thing, the classic fake news story that we're getting these days, or fake information story that we're getting is, and it's an old one, I'm sure everyone here in the audience remembers the kid on the avenue who was approached as a child by a fellow in a white van, came up, the child miraculously managed to get away. What we're seeing now is a lot of these stories, they're happening again. It's the warm time of year, you get a child who's approached on an avenue. What we're seeing now increasingly is the person may often is always in a white van, often of an ethnic descent, be it black, be it Eastern European, goes back to the parents, tells the story, it goes on Facebook, and suddenly it explodes. These kinds of accounts we're getting all the time. The guards have gotten them all the time, but now they're being reported online. We investigate them, and inevitably 99% of them are false. But by us not reporting them, by us reporting that they're fake, you're then calling to account a child's version of events, which would appear to be false. Then you're kind of feeding into into this kind of idea that Jane spoke about earlier about this day, about people who want to have it verified that mainstream media isn't reporting the types of stories that they perceive as fitting with their idea. So that's just kind of one example of what we're seeing. But as regards a coordinated effort, I haven't seen any evidence of it yet, but that's not to say it wouldn't happen. It couldn't happen quite soon.
We have to be careful not to look at it just from a US viewpoint and think, okay, is it appearing in exactly the same way as it is in the US? If you take things like advertorials, native advertising that isn't labelled, is that fake news? It's being put out as news agencies as the true story for something. It's intent to deceive in the same way that fake news is. Like, to me, that would be fake news in an Irish context that is eroding trust in the media. And I think sometimes if we look at things and we say, is it happening exactly the same as it is in the US? No, because there are different economic reasons. Ireland's a small country as well. You know, lots of the US fake news is driven from sites outside of the US as well, that they're just doing it to make money. Like you said, it's the economic incentive. You're not going to get as much of an economic incentive writing about Ireland. So you're not going to get outside actors who think, I'm going to write loads of hilarious stories about Enderkenny, and it's going to make me millions, because you know, people in Nigeria probably aren't going to read it as much. So I think it isn't appearing as much in the same way, but there are articles that are written to deceive readers that are eroding trust.
I think advertorials have always been done, though. That's the one thing.
Fake news has always been around as well.
Yeah, fake news has always been around as well. But I think that when, as long as promoted and native content, as you correctly manage, as long as it's labelled correctly.
But there's lots that isn't labelled, right?
Yeah, that is true as well. Yeah.
But that's always been kind of part of it as well. I mean, like, you know, as loads of talk, I'm thinking, like, my own background is in music journalism, culture journalism. The amount of kind of, like, I mean, junkets, the amount of kind of freebies, like, and it's rarely labelled. And the Guardian brought in a situation, like, a couple of years ago where they started labelling it, and things began to change there. Like, I want to kind of bring it back to, like, I suppose, a couple of things you've all mentioned. I want to talk to Kevin about this. It's like, I mean, you've all kind of mentioned, like, I mean, social media in one way or another, just kind of in passing, you know. Have you kind of found, Kevin, from your point of view, that, like, it's kind of like, is the likes of Facebook where basically these stories are kind of like me fermenting, and like then when they spread to mainstream media, that's where the problems begin, or is the problems already kind of like inherent when they're on Facebook?
I think the problem is that they sometimes don't spread to outside media, and they're just they just exist. So a fake news story exists on Facebook, it attracts 500,000 shares, it's seen by, it may be an American news story, but it's seen by maybe 10,000 Irish people who believe it. And journalists, we by and large, kind of, if we do engage with social media, to great a degree, live on Twitter. And Facebook is just that crazy Facebook post that your uncle shared. It doesn't bother us. And then Brexit and the American presidential election happened last year, and we thought, oh, actually, maybe we should pay more attention to what my uncle shared on Facebook. And, you know, there are things that get 500,000 shares and are not reported. And that started to change as this fake news, this combating fake news industry has kind of shifted into gear in the last 12 months. But we have been quite slow to respond to it up until then.
What do you think about that, like, Jay? What Kevin just said there about the weight of kind of like shares. Like, he's talking about his uncle's post getting 500,000 like shares.
I don't have a racist uncle.
There was a guy when there was, you know, a small kind of riot in the US, and a guy with, I think he'd, you know, 80 followers or something, and he took a photograph of some buses and said, you know, obviously these people were bussed in, and then this was taken up by some of the hyper-partisan websites, and the whole thing went out of control. I think he ended up with like 5 million shares. It went on to Breitbart, it went, you know, all over the place. So, you know, even something very small can be taken up by hyper-partisan sites and shared out. Like, if you look at the French election, there was a coalition, which actually Storyful were part of, called Crosscheck, that these guys are first draft, and Newswhip were another great Irish startup who kind of monitored things moving fast. So what they did is they monitored the stories, and they could see as they were getting lots of shares. But once they stayed in the kind of hyper-partisan space, then they didn't do anything about them, because if you did, one of the weird things about fake news is if you actually repeat the fake news in the headline and say it's false, people will just read the fake news part and they won't see the false part and they believe it. So you have to not even repeat the fakery in the headline. Is really weird the way people kind of consume the news. So what they would do then is, at the first instance that they saw it moving onto kind of mainstream Facebook, then they'd be ready with their kind of fact-checking and their verification. And it was a whole coalition of, I think, about 12 different news organisations, and AFP, the big French news agency, would put it out to everybody. But then they tried to do the same thing in the British general election, but the British media didn't want to work together to do... Exactly, they didn't want to cooperate in the same way, so they're not doing it the same way in the British one. But the thing is that, like, over like in our research, I think it's about 70% of the under 35s in Ireland get their news on Facebook. So they don't ever go to independent.ie, or they don't go to the Journal, or they don't go to the Dublin Inquirer. They get their news on Facebook, and they might see independent stories there or Dublin Inquirer stories there, but they never actually go back. So, you know, what actually travels on Facebook is the thing that matters, and what Facebook does. Like, they used to have editors who would have a look at things and make decisions. Yeah. And then the right wing, you know, the Breitbart and Fox went mad about this and were on at them that, you know, it was partisan and left wing. So they dropped them. And as soon as they dropped them, that just allowed, like, massive space for then fake news to come in, because what the guys did is they've loads of these bots that they just put out. So you might have 500,000 bots pushing a fake story, and then the algorithm thinks that this is moving really fast, but it's just artificially kind of gone. Mm. So they did that on purpose. So now they're trying to bring people back into the equation. So, yeah, it's pretty tricky.
I think 20 years from now, or 30 years from now, we'll all realise that the algorithm was actually the new Black Death, and it's what's, like, I mean, it contributed to the kind of decline of civilization. But, like, pulling on from what you just said there, Jen, I want to ask kind of, like, Lois and kind of mm-hmm. call about this one. It comes down, you said something interesting, Lois, we're in the green room, and it kind of, in my mind, and we're talking about, like, the confirmation bias and readers, it's what readers want to know, and you're talking about, like educating readers in some kind of way, or is that the way forward? I'm kind of thinking about what, like, Jane's just talked about there, that, like, 70% of under 35s get their news on Facebook. They don't want to know about Dublin Inquirer. They don't want to know about the Irish Independent. They don't want to know about the Irish Times. Mm-hmm. So it's like, what's going to be the solution then?
I think educating readers is one thing, but I think, like, as I was saying, it seems to be that there is, like, at the moment, there's lots of focus on fact-checking and making sure that you're verifying stuff, and that's really, really important. But actually, like you say, people trust stuff based on who shares it. So from a media organization point of view, how do you actually compete on that battlefield as well? So you're doing all the fact-checking, you're doing the transparency about sources, you're doing all the stuff that if people who are media literate and are looking for that kind of stuff can see, okay, that's how they got it, that's you know, maybe that's a bit flimsy, that's not flimsy. But then how do we have an emotional connection with readers that they think, okay, that's a person, I know who Dublin Inquirer is, I know who all their reporters are, they're very transparent about who they are, I know when to trust them, when not to trust them. And I think organizations, we need to address basically the trust issue as a whole. That's where the battleground is. So how do media organizations, like, build that connection with our readers that they're going to, when they see it, they kind of know who's sharing it, and there's that emotional response as well.
Right, so in many ways what you're saying then is, like, you know, like, the bigger battlefield is one we can't win.
Why can't we win it?
The bigger battlefield, I mean, like, you're kind of saying there about, I mean, establishing a connection with your readers, you know. I mean, I'm talking about, like, the bigger number, the 70% of people who've actually kind of, like, given up on kind of what we call the conventional media and are just, like, trusting things like Facebook.
Well, I think you can win them back. Like, I think it's about, like, meeting people in the real world, doing things like running events where you're having face-to-face connections with them, and putting long-term investment in winning them back rather than just sort of blaming them for sharing things from people they know. Actually looking, okay, what are these fake news websites? What are they providing that these readers like? And there's the confirmation bias thing, but they're resonating on, like, some kind of emotional level with people. Mm. So how do we sort of tap into that?
Right. Just like, pulling away from this, and just kind of, like, I suppose, question for Jane and for Carl. In many ways, do you think, like, I mean, the established media are kind of, like, not helping their own cause by, like, having lots of clickbaity stories themselves? I mean, going down that particular rabbit hole. And as we all know, if you go down that rabbit hole, it's very hard to come back out of it.
Very hard. Well, like, if you just look at the numbers that the New York Times is putting on, and reportedly the Washington Post, though they don't actually release their figures, they're absolutely enormous. And that's because in, you know, the kind of chaos in America at the moment, people want investigative journalism, they want analysis, they want something more. So, you know, they're clearly demonstrating that if you do that and you provide more and you provide the investigations and so on, they're too big to have, you know, obviously the personal thing can work, you know, in a small publication. But, you know, the New York Times isn't going to be able to go out and personally meet people. But, you know, there's a lot of people, just purely because of Fahrenthal's investigative journalism, are willing to pay for it. So I think there's a real message that media needs to be pushing resources into that kind of thing, into in-depth investigations, into transparency, into showing the kind of value added that they can add, and really questioning the value of the clickbait, questioning the value of anything which can undermine the trust in the brand, which can be, you know, from commercial or kind of political things. So I think people are beginning to see the kind of deliberate triggering of their emotions, like anger on social, and they don't particularly want that in newspapers. And, you know, some newspapers are just in that habit. So I think to move away from that and try to provide depth.
The other thing we see is it is interesting the point that Kevin makes about his uncle and Facebook, and what we're seeing is that, and independent.ie in particular, like, less than 10% of our social traffic, even our social traffic, is coming from Twitter. It's all from Facebook. Mm-hmm. Facebook is where, unfortunately, and it would appear to be where people are getting the news. But it's not like it's us against Facebook. There are, like, people are going on Facebook and they're going on the Independent account, or they're going on the Dublin Inquirer account, they're going on, they're liking these pages as well. So it's not a case of we're giving Facebook have control of you now. I do agree with Jane to a point about the clickbaity type of articles, I think, and we can see that in our... If you have a headline that suggests the article gives you more, and it gives you more, then people like those kinds of stories. But if you have an article going, you'll never guess what this person bought in a shop today, and the answer is a burger or something like that, people aren't happy with that.
Yeah.
But if there is a like the idea, the way people are consuming news now is quite different from maybe how they would consume it before when they're buying a newspaper. So sometimes you do need headlines that are different, that are tailored to a different audience online. And it's important not to mistake clickbait for what is a more online suited headline, or a story that suggests more or promises more, or even a headline that might ask a question, you know.
Or even I've seen it with the Irish Times. Like, I mean, a lot of articles, especially say Fintan O'Toole articles, for some reason the paper headline bears no resemblance to what's online. Online is kind of five reasons why Fintan's got it right this week, whereas in the paper it's something kind of a lot more serious.
I think also with clickbait, it makes people question where are you putting your resources and why are you putting them there, and that also leads to kind of a like they see loads of what they think of as important stories, and they don't understand why something else is being covered, like the best burger, rather than that. Mm. And you know, inside a newsroom, that's we have to get this many stories out, and we can, you know, and the level of resources that each story takes is different, and this is how it ends up being allocated. But I think on the long term, if you see 20 clickbait stories and two decent ones, the two decent ones get sort of eclipsed in a way.
Part of the problem is the advertising model, though. So at the moment, like the way people get their advertising online is through this kind of programmatic advertising. So like if I'm a brand, I just go to one of the agencies and I say, you know, buy me this many people with this demographic, and they don't care kind of where it is. And so we see 80% of the revenue going to Facebook and Google. And then within that, we see they, you know, beginning to have a small kind of kickback where, you know, brands have been advertising against hate speech or against things that are, you know, nothing to do with their values. But the same thing happens, that same model applies to, you know, people who are buying the space on Independent or anywhere else. So, like, one of the answers has to be to actually change some of the parameters within that advertising model, that it actually, you talk about kind of how long somebody stays on a story, or, you know, whether they're actually engaging with it or doing different things, because at the moment it's mostly based on clicks. So then the advertising department has got a huge incentive to try to push out lots of this click stuff that, you know, so they can rack up the clicks so they can get the advertising revenue in. So, you know what I mean? It's a kind of a chicken and egg. I think you have to look at changing the...
I think we'd look at all...
The advertising.
We'd have three or four different kind of stats systems that we look at. And what I love to see from a story is engagement time. Yeah. If you've got someone on a story for longer than a minute, you know your success. Like...
So if that was in the advertising model, you were going to get more advertising revenue for that.
Yeah, but so we were encouraging those kinds of stories now. In particular, we're always trying to put longer reads towards the top of the website because it's longer engagement time. It's obviously holding the reader's interest. You do need a certain element of variety. Like you need the lighter stories. You need the Pippa Middleton's wedding. Yeah. You need something else to kind of keep people entertained. But the longer engagement stories, I think, are, like Jane says, they're the key, really.
But there's also a conflict between the advertising model and a reader support model. Like advertising, if you talk about it, you're still talking about writing content for advertisers, not for readers. You're still talking about taking into account what they need, and it's always going to distort it. So, I mean, if you look at The Guardian, it shrunk back from the US because it sees that it can't even, the number of readers they have, they can't get the money from advertising to do it. So I don't think even if you make these adjustments, you're going to get the money you need to be able to fund good journalism. So then you want to turn to readers because they're the people who are, you hope, that's a natural alignment of good journalism and interests, what readers want. Mm. But that conflicts with the advertising model because you're trying to get more. So I think it's a hard transitional period for places if they're trying to build up different sources of revenue, but they're a bit conflicting.
Kevin?
Yeah, like, well... I think there's two types of kind of experiments going on at the moment. There's let's see if we can actually make money from advertising, and that experiment isn't particularly happening for anyone apart from Google and Facebook. And like even if you get the engagement and they're sitting on the page, it's questionable how much they're actually engaging with the ad that sits there, or whether they have an ad blocker, like the amount of people who have ad blocker software on their browser these days. The other thing is, like Lois was saying about like the way the Guardian are moving towards, by the way, will you give us some money, you know, at the end of the article. But you could see the really good top quality journalism, like the New York Times, like the in-depth stuff on the New York Times and the Guardian, going into this kind of middle-brow ghetto where, you know, hard-hitting investigative news is the same as classical music because, you know, there's a small section of people who will pay for it, but no one else will. So you, that brings you back to the advertising model, which is how, you know, the Sun tried to play paywall, and that's long since gone. They need to figure out a way to, you know, the Sun or whoever's going to replace the Sun in the digital age, need to figure out a way to reach a mass audience, do good journalism, and still actually make money.
With a much smaller budget as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So let's move away from the depressing areas of budget and economic discovery.
It's
we're not going to solve this because much smarter minds than those have taken years and they haven't been able to sort it. I want to kind of pick up on something that kind of Jane said earlier on about like hyper-partisan kind of like conservative websites, you know, and the way they're kind of like spreading certain kind of like news stories. However, like Carl, it's not just kind of like the right wing who are responsible kind of like for any kind of amplification of these stories.
Certainly what we've seen, in particular, the types of stories that are being generated to I suppose, with a bias. And I'm conscious that there are legal proceedings going on at the moment, but we are seeing there is a high-profile case going on at the moment, and reports are going up online that are being taken from a court case with a very heavily slanted bias. And I think we're probably reaching quite a dangerous point here whereby court reporting, as we talked about earlier, is kind of sacred. It's you're in the court, you report what happens in court, and it goes into the media. We don't have even a reporter down at that particular trial. It's taken from an agency. But meanwhile, there's another alternative report going online with a very heavy bias. For example, I've seen well-known celebrities speaking outside of the court, outside of the confines of what's happening here. The jury are going to see this. It's very hard to see how a fair trial can actually happen in this case, and it could potentially be an issue of contempt. If we were to do this, if we were to report on a court case with a heavy sense of bias, we'd be up, myself, yourself, Jane, or any of us would be up in front of the judge tomorrow and could potentially face a fine or even imprisonment for contempt of court. But this seems to be happening in Facebook from one particular group.
Yeah. Okay, so like putting on that, I mean, you said something earlier on, Lois, you were kind of talking about, like, I mean, when we were talking about this beforehand, you were talking about, like, in that case, when it comes to that court reporting, it's about better training for the alternative news sources. Do you think the alternative news sources want that better training?
Yeah, I think they do. We had a joint course with the Centre for Investigative Journalism in the UK just Thursday, Friday, with lots of alternative media sources in Ireland who are doing their best, but they just don't have, they've never had the resources to be able to train. They've never had mentorship. They're as interested in the truth as anybody else. Maybe there are going to be some partisan, politically driven, but actually, I think, and I think some groups are conscious that they don't want to undercut themselves by getting things wrong. They know that they have also, what they're actually trying to do also is reach out to more mainstream publications with wider readership and make sure that they're credible when they reach out to them. So they want to be able to check all the stories that they're putting out in press releases. I think there's a real, I don't think that we can say, and I don't think that we can say we are the real journalists, just trust us. Like, it's just not going to work.
Okay. Jane, take us from your point of view then, from the kind of like your perch at DC School of Communications. What we talked about there, I mean, Colin knows I'm very careful not mentioning the court case. We're not going to mention the court case. But in that kind of way, it's like there's an accepted way of reporting court cases. This is how it goes. Like, sub judice rules, okay. You don't want to get called up in front of the judge. And then we've got this kind of like meme, let's call this social media reporting on what's going on. I've seen stuff on social media about the court case in question that it's just like, I'm kind of going like, what? I mean, I wouldn't get away with that. Carl wouldn't get away with that. No one, any national newspaper would get away with that. So why aren't they being hauled up in front of the beak?
Probably hasn't seen it.
Right. Yeah. We have seen there was a trial.
Yeah, but like, I'm sure if the judge actually saw it, then he would call them, like, he would be obliged to, like, if there was contempt of court and he saw it, he would be obliged to say, you must desist, and give an order to them to desist. Yeah. So, I can't imagine that a judge would actually see that and make a decision not to call contempt.
Right.
Because, yeah, so I think the only answer could be that he hasn't seen it. But then, on the other hand, if people are purporting, to be, like, it's a very difficult line, isn't it, between what's an alternative news source, who's a citizen journalist, you know what I mean? Mm. Like, the, you know, if you're standing with a smartphone when something is happening and, you know, Storyfolk get your video, you're a citizen journalist, you know, so the lines aren't as kind of demarcated anymore. You don't necessarily have a degree from us, or you haven't gone through training in The Independent, or, you know, that kind of thing from when I was training, that everybody would have had to have done something or other. So I think it's probably, there's some interest in, like, if Lois is right, that these people would actually welcome training, well, then maybe, you know, it would be worthwhile to go to a philanthropic source and try to get training and source it and, you know, do it here. So
I think mainstream newsrooms would be happy to have groups in and to work with alternative news sites, because I don't think there's any kind of opposition, provided, I suppose,
when, and we could do it as well, if there was some, you know, resources to do it. Like, it's not,
especially the work the Dublin Inquirer has done, it's like, and it would often be commended within our offices, because it is. Yeah. Right.
Let's kind of move away from kind of contentious court cases, and let's move on to something that happened in alleged to happen on St. Stephen's Day last year on Henry Street in Dublin, when there was an alleged riot. It was then covered by a newspaper called The Liberal, a publication, an online site called The Liberal. And talk to me about this, because you said something in a conversation with me about, like, the time it takes to kind of, like, verify stories. This is something Kevin would talk about as well. Yeah. Like, talk us through that, because I mean, you had a lot of very good points to make about this.
Yeah, I thought that this was, I suppose people might remember it. It was on St. Stephen's Day.
If anyone's in this room, they remember it.
Yeah, there was an incident on Henry Street. It's important to remember, and it was actually, it wasn't even deliberate that broke the story first. It was actually a story in the Evening Herald, or the Herald. I shouldn't be calling it Evening Herald. But they reported on this incident, a number of youths involved in a fight, a bit of fracas, a couple of arrests, public order incidents. I remember on that day, because we take the stories from the Herald, we put it up on Independent.ie, and I got contacted by our moderators who look at our comments, and our moderators are like, you need to look at the comments. There's an awful lot of things being said that we're having to remove. And it was, everyone was going, you're hiding the truth here, And I then was quickly alerted to a story on The Liberal about how suddenly this skirmish amongst a couple of young lads on Henry Street had turned into a race riot, and basically we had turned into downtown LA circa 1993, and there were different factions from different parts, different Bloods and Crips going wild. Essentially, is what he's saying. I'm being a bit facetious here, but this is the kind of the tenet of the Liberal story, and then it went on to suggest that mainstream media wasn't covering the truth behind the story. And the story grew massive traction. We could see it, and, like, we were watching Newswhip, we were watching Spike, seeing just how many people were clicking on, how many people were engaging with it. And we were kind of forced into then looking into it further. It became kind of a situation. We maintained the report as it was, it stayed as it was. It was a kind of a simple skirmish. But this is something that we are kind of seeing. It was one of the first very real examples of where a fake news story was being pulled out of a real story or out of a kind of a real report, and I thought it was kind of a dangerous precedent. Again, now the site then kind of got there was a backlash, which is good to see as well. The likes of Dublin Inquirer did great actual work on it as well, and looking at it, and Journal and a few others, and there's a bit of a backlash. But then there was a kind of a video emerged. I don't know if you remember that. Yeah. There was a video emerged of this American couple, and, you know, we don't know how verifiable it was, describing the riot itself. So it was quite an interesting...
Okay, so let's pause it there. Like, that video by an American couple, how would you go about verifying that, Kevin?
First of all, you'd actually have to try and find the original source. There's an awful lot of examples of videos just shared from the first place a journalist or reporter or whoever is sharing it has seen it online. Sometimes you'll see live leak in the top there or bottom right of the video. You should always treat that with a massive pinch of salt. But if you can, if it does look like this is the first person to upload it, they look like they have a pretty reliable Twitter account, Facebook account, Instagram, wherever they post it the first time, you're getting in touch with them. You're trying to ideally get them on the phone, just old-fashioned reporting like you would before the age of social media. You're also looking at what features in the video. So let's say, for example, it's an assault on the street in Dublin. Is that the street that the person says it's on? Can you verify that? Generally, Google Street View is the quickest and easiest way to do that. Yes, that is Grafton Street. Has anyone else talked about that? It was again. Let's say Grafton Street for this made-up example. have other people spoken about this? You would imagine if there was an assault on Grafton Street, someone else might have tweeted about it. You search Grafton Street, you see someone else has tweeted about it. If you don't get all of that, it's not to say the video is unverifiable. We have tools ourselves that we can look to see if a similar video has been uploaded previously. But you do exercise caution and you say, we wouldn't use this, and we will say to all the newsrooms, you make your own decision, but we would advise you not to use it. We don't have enough. And it's okay to say, we can't verify this. Like there's sometimes you kind of believe you've got this kind of slam dunk, yes, it's verified, or this is debunked, this is a fake. And there's an awful lot of grey areas where you say, it's hard to say, we don't have enough information. But, you know, call on the uploader, call on the guards and saying, have you got any reports of this happening? And we'll go a long way towards doing it.
Right, that's excellent. There's another excellent example of that by an ex-Storyful dude called Malachy Brown on New York Times at the moment about an assault inside a Turkish embassy recently. Yeah. So let's go back to that riot on Henry Street then. Like, Lois, did you cover that, didn't you?
No, we didn't cover that. We covered other liberal stuff to do with just fake competitions that they were running.
Okay, let's actually go through that fake competition. That was on my list of things to do, you know. This is something again that, like, again, everyone in this room is very aware of. And I mean, on the Liberal, there are competitions for pennies vouchers. I think maybe maybe a couple of iPhones given away. And you know, you did digging into who actually won these prizes.
Yes, what we did is we basically scraped. We used a computer program to scrape everything from the Facebook page for it was actually her.ie, which was the not her.ie. Sorry, her.ie. What was it called? Pretty.ie.
Which
was the going to be the sister site for liberal.ie, and I think it's sort of hasn't ever regained the same level of likes that it had. But it was building up an audience by running competitions. It actually hadn't put out any stories yet. But we were interested, you know, in that you never hear from the people who win the competitions, and there were lots of sort of rumours flying around on social media that nobody ever wins. So we basically scraped all the information into a database from that Facebook page and looked at whether it was possible for the people who were said to have won to have won. By timing of when they posted or whether they posted or not, whether the names appeared of the winners or not, and could not find any of the winners. So that was just basically using, you know, a scraping tool to analyze it, and it was actually pretty simple to do.
Right, okay. James?
Yeah, well, I think it's just, like, you see, you know, in Frankfurt, there was, you know, a lot of made-up stories about, you know, kind of mass rapes one year and all that kind of thing. So these things happen all around the world. And then, you know, even though, as Cottle says, we're not as polarised a system, we're not as politically polarised as, you know, the UK and the US, which have the, you know, two big kind of competing parties and then, you know, people on either side and the media system isn't as polarised here, but still you can see actors who would be in those kind of hyper-partisan spaces, whether they're on, you know, fairly far right or fairly far left, what they will do is try to take inspiration from the kind of tactics that have worked internationally. Yeah. And so I can only imagine that the Frankfurt was an inspiration for the Henry Street nonsense.
Okay. I want to kind of come back to something like, you know, that Kevin, Lois and Carl Book all talked about there, and that was like, I mean, their individual kind of like verification process and the way they work things, be it like, I mean, you were given an example of kind of that we talked about a possible assault on Graft Street, you talked about like, I mean, scraping all the pre.e stuff and working it out, and you talked about like, I mean, the footwork, the gumshoe footwork, going to the guards, finding out what's going on. Do you think readers appreciate this? Or is it a certain percentage of readers? And is it the case then that we've got to kind of go for those readers who appreciate the hard work we're putting in? And when I say we, I mean, like be it like New York Times, Washington Post, Independent, Dublin Inquirer, Storyful, people who appreciate that kind of like that digging in. Is it the case we go for them and forget about everyone else?
I think there's some of the research that has been done has shown that people like the idea of transparency. So, okay, maybe only 2 in 100 will actually go and look at the digging in if you provide it. So if you think about kind of Malachy's story yesterday on the New York Times, anybody here should go to see it. It's amazing, amazing work Malachy Brown did on the New York Times, identifying all the Turkish operatives who were beating people up. But, you know, there might only be 2 in 100 who want to go in and look at the kind of the detail of how he actually did that. and what the videos were and so on. And you saw on the site even there was the little videos you could go into and kind of watch it. But another 50 or 60 out of the 100 are going to be reassured knowing that you can do it if you want to. Mm-hmm. Or they might do it once and never do it again. So I think the kind of principle of that kind of full transparency and showing it and being able to demonstrate that, OK, we've got this clip of a politician that's for 15 seconds, but if you want to, here's the full thing it's come from, so you can see we haven't taken it out of context, you know, or we've got this clip of, you know, a child on a beach, but here's the, actually the, everything that was going on around. Very few people are going to have the time to go and do that, but they might do it sometimes, but they're going to be very reassured that that kind of transparency is there. I think the same is true of Storyful. Like, a lot of news organisations use Storyful for verification, but they just use it internally. They don't actually demonstrate to their readers that, in fact, this is being verified by Storyful. So there probably would be an opportunity then to actually say, well, look, it's actually verified by Storyful, and actually please give us a process tracing thing, Storyful, so if people are interested, they can go and see how it was verified. You know, very few people might go and do it, but it would provide reassurance. So I think it's something, I think as people become more media literate and understand more what's going on, they want that reassurance and that kind of transparency, even if they're not going to have time to do it every time themselves.
It sounds lovely, but I worry, like, I think it would be brilliant if we could do that for every single story. Like, I rang 50 councillors, I knocked on 75 doors.
There will be automatic ways of doing it.
Yeah, like, I do worry about the resources that could be involved and the amount of time and effort that a good journalist could be wasting when...
Yeah, exactly.
But is it waste when, like, I mean, it basically...
waste is probably the wrong word. A good journalist could be spending, like, the amount of time we
have to
spend...
At the moment, it's very difficult, but there's one project we're working on with, like, a cool German research institute who do lots of automatic things. So as you're actually working, it could keep track of it, and then you could decide how much of that to display afterwards and that kind of thing.
That
and
is
then
two,
you know what I mean. So
it
wouldn't take up any of your time, but afterwards you could choose to display some of your work, and then that could kind of build up trust and transparency. Because I think, you know, there's tackling fake news, and there's fact checking, there's media literacy and helping people understand. You see the ads that Facebook ran in the UK election saying, you know, check the URLs, and you're kind of going, Facebook, you kind of had the most AI in the world. Could you not be checking the URLs rather than asking other people to? But you know, so there's that literacy, and then there's the whole thing about Facebook and Google, and you know, the extent to which they're willing to compromise their business model to make sure that absolute crap isn't put out there.
As a reader-supported publication, like, it's definitely worth our while. Every time we do stories that are public interest and that are really well reported, we'll get more subscriptions. Like, it just, and that's what I mean about, like, the things lining up. Yeah. And I think one of the things also is that, like you say, it does take a lot of time. So, people bash journalists a lot, but really we should be bashing editors and publishers. Because they're the people who are setting the culture in the newsroom. They're the people who are giving journalists the space to do it or not the space to do it. They're the people who are deciding the business model. So, I don't know, I'd like to see them under a bit more.
My door is open for a financier and Paul O'Neill to happily come along to this banter and talk about it. No problem at all. Last question for me before we get some questions from the audience. Where do we think it's going to go from here? Like, you know, like as we've made very clear from the very, very start, it's a great interview. It's a great piece in 1863 magazine from the Economist at the moment saying that fake news is always around. It's giving examples in the 16th, 17th century. We've talked about that earlier on as well. But where do you see the current situation going?
Depending on the day, I feel very optimistic or pessimistic. But at the moment, I think bigger problem than fake news, as you say, fake news has always been around. There has been, there will always be people who just want to make a quick buck or just want to just mess things up for their own reasons. But what's more corrosive is a distrust of the media. And this is the story that people don't want you to read, or the media won't report on this. And an awful lot of the time it's the media won't report on this, but the media have reported on this, you just haven't seen it yet. And that's fine, and you know, having a distrust of power is not a bad thing. But when a story has been covered and has been covered well and it's still not believed, I think that's a bigger issue. And when it's dismissed as fake media by fake news by, you know, the President of the United States, and it's actually very, very good award-winning news, then you've got a problem. So it's more about just general distrust of the media than, I think, some kind of the odd egregious incident of just basic fake news.
Right, Jane.
Yeah, I think there's the in some ways the election of Trump has actually been a really good thing from this point of view, because there's a lot of people now who are actually paying attention to it. There was people shouting about it beforehand, but now we can actually see it. Even in the UK, there's investigations into kind of Brexit and, you know, the kind of targeting that was done of people to, you know, on Facebook
and so on. Carl Cadwalader's series in The Observer is excellent.
Amazing, yeah. And so, you know, there's a lot of attention. There's philanthropic money from America, even the European Commission is there. So I think there's Mark Little, who founded Storyful, was at the Online News Association last Friday and just talking a tiny bit about like a new startup that he might do, which would be something in the area. There's other so there's lots of people kind of looking at it and trying to do things. And so that would make me optimistic that hopefully lots of these disparate kind of things can come together, because at least now there's attention and understanding. There's people have turned out on a rainy Saturday in Dublin to hear about it, you know. So I think that's a good thing. You wouldn't necessarily have had that 2 or 3 years ago.
Well, we got a great fake news headline of what Jane just said there, you know. Election of Trump, quote, a good thing, Jane.
Future lost.
I'm optimistic about the shift towards subscriber-supported business models. So whether it's, you know, places like the New York Times, or you've got The Correspondent in the Netherlands that is then moving, you know, looking at doing stuff in the US as well. And I think that that will focus publications on winning the trust of readers. And I think that is ultimately going to be the, you know, the way forward.
Okay. I think just as a journalist, I'm just going to keep making phone calls, knocking doors, and really let the higher powers worry about fake news, and just hope that our readers will trust, and the people who read my copy will trust it. You know, I think if I spend my days worrying about fake news and other websites, it could actually damage my own job and my own output. So that's kind of the way I'm focusing for the future, and hope that things will kind of work itself out on a journalistic level.
Excellent. That's a great optimistic note to ending things on before we get questions from the audience. So we have two microphones, one here, and I'm not sure where the other one is. Oh, it's up there. So just put your hand up and we'll get a microphone to you if you've got a question. Or have we covered every single... it's amazing. Everything. The minute you say those words, have we covered everything? Someone also has their hand up. So a woman here at the back row.
I was just wondering about fear and anxiety, because you said feeding on people's fears. So how does the media work or understand... how people's fears are amplified and how they become more, and there's more anxiety in the media, or do you think there isn't?
I'll take that first. I think it's definitely done to far too great an extent that we publications do play on the fears of people. A story about how something might hurt you will probably, in some publications, do better than a story about something that might help you. And just the way that headlines are framed, and you know, you'll see research again and again about, you know, say crime goes down, but people think it's going up, and you know that there's loads of variations of that example. So I think it's always been something that newspapers and the media have known this is a way to sell if we play on fear, but it's probably in. The good thing is you can build your own bubbles on social media, so if you want to just have a safe space, it's probably potentially a little bit easier, but no, it's definitely something that's done. Whether it's always malicious or not is a different matter. You know, like newspapers could argue, you need to know this, but it's definitely something that's done, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, and then, but the other thing is that while it's always been done, and we know that... you know, triggering people's fear and anger are the two most powerful things, you know, much more powerful than trying to trigger happiness and so on. That can kind of almost be weaponized on social media, and it can be targeted at individuals on their account depending on the kind of things that they've been saying and they've been looking at. And, you know, the series that Jim was talking about there, that Carol Caldwalader did in The Guardian, you know, showed how that was actually used in Brexit. So it's instead of having this kind of generalised, you know, scary headlines that the newspapers used to have, you now have, deliberately targeted headlines that are targeted at individuals that are just there to trigger negative emotions. Mm-hmm. And that's what the algorithms do. They make money for Facebook out of triggering negative emotions.
I think there was a study from the American Press Institute really recently that looked at that there maybe is a slight shift in that people are, a greater number of people are more annoyed at sort of polemical, shouty, anxiety-inducing opinion pieces, and there are a lot more people searching around for more in-depth explanations of what is going on. So I don't know, maybe that might change a bit if more people start to do that. I don't know, it's optimistic.
Yeah, I worked as a crime reporter for 4.5 years, and there's some very scary stuff out there as well. So there is this kind of, I do get what you're saying, but you can't mask stories that are about horrific crimes or horrific events happening. You can't make them, you can't dampen them down or try and make them more widespread or try and make them more balanced. Sorry, I'm not using the correct terminology, but I guess you know what I'm saying here.
More palatable.
More palatable just because you're afraid of scaring people, you know. For example, the death of Alan Haw and Alan Haw's murder of his entire family, the media in that case were accused of being overly sympathetic to the man who killed his family, of almost not striking more fear into the readers. So here there has to be a balance made whereby you are you going to dampen down the truth about a story just for the sake of not offending a couple of maybe liberal-minded people? Or do you try to find that balance? You have to try and strike a line through.
Yeah, but then there's the opposite of that call as well, where it's ramped up. You know, I mean, I live in North Union City, and as far as I'm concerned, if I read some newspapers, I'm walking around Compton back in 1992.
But there is a serious problem in the North Union City. There's with a serious
problem, the serious problem is nowhere near as exaggerated as sometimes when I read certain reports.
And there's a lot of wonderful stuff going on too. That actually, if you open some newspapers, it's all crime and blood and guts and shootings, and that's not a picture of the city.
But it's not normal in a society for a gang to go around and murder 9 or 10 people in a year, purely because of a grudge or this. Like, are we going to deny that this is happening? Absolutely.
But I think a lot of the things about fear call are actually more about the kind of things about fear of, you know, your borders being overrun, or fear...
Well, yeah, no, absolutely, I totally agree with you.
The Daily Mail model.
I'm referring more to kind of the Irish model and the Irish reporting on crime and speaking from that perspective. And I do agree with you that fear around non-nationals in Ireland with certain types of stories, for example, like the one I gave you about the men in the white vans or the woman who's selling her child outside Lidl in Limerick. You might remember that story was a couple of weeks ago. There was a story about a woman who was apparently approaching people trying to sell her child outside
in
Limerick. And it was picked up by a freelancer down there and sent around to all the national newspapers. Some of them ran it, including RTE. Turns out it was complete bunkum, complete rubbish. It was someone had written it on Facebook. And this was another example of fake news that was driven by a fear of the outsider and that people from a different background would do something like this.
Right, so that's the motive there. But going back to something Kevin said this earlier on, it's been playing in my mind, which is some of the reasons behind fake news was attention. And we saw this with the Manchester during the week, certain stories were put up there for basically reasons of grabbing attention. Do you think that's a generational thing in some ways?
I think it is. To be honest, sometimes I can't fathom what, I can, in a really grotesque way, you can kind of almost understand someone wants Twitter followers. But in the immediate aftermath of a bombing, for example, you go to YouTube. The Brussels attacks last year at the airport, and within half an hour, there was a video from 5 years previously in Russia. It was another airport bombing, but someone had, the minute they heard that an airport bombing had happened, they said, "Right, I'm going to find an old airport CCTV, put it on YouTube and get some clicks." And there was no monetary value in that. It was taken down, and debunked quite quickly. Some news places did run with it. But it was, I don't know, there's just people who think, I'm just going to throw something into the cogs at the moment and see what happens. But
do you think it's done out of mischief, or is it done out of...
Yeah, there's a bit of that kind of 4chan element,
It's not mischief, that's racism.
Yeah. Well, no, sorry. Yeah, 4chan is definitely racism, but people who would argue, no, we're not being racist, we're being subversive. And it's like, no, you're being racist. But that kind of, like, where it just gets twisted and there's people who feel that they're somehow kind of messing with the system in some way. You know?
Okay, next question. It's loads of questions over here. We'll start here with the woman in the front row, and then we'll get up to you, okay? And then what we'll try and do is we'll try and, instead of getting the whole panel to answer the question, maybe if you want to kind of, if the question is directed at one person, just pick a person at random if the question is general. So it's like
I'll
search.
Pick Lois because you've just converted me to become a reader of your publication. Lois I could say, but actually I'm just thinking to ask a constructive question. Would more reporting on the grey make things better? Because so much of the fake news is so polarised, mm-hmm. and life isn't polarised, mm-hmm. and I'm real conscious of that at the moment. I mean, I read multiple publications trying to find a way through what news is, and life is grey. There's so many different facets to life, and reporting seems to be mostly polarised. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, well, I think a part of the problem with that is also the way that what we're defining as news is often breaking news or news that's lacking a lot of context. And part of that is the speed thing as well, that some publications don't have the time to go in and to properly report. Okay, if we're talking about crime, like, you know, to put in the stats that, okay, the chance of this happening to you is 1 in 1 billion. You know, and I think that I think that reporting on the grey. I mean, I'm not somebody who believes in balance. To be honest, I believe that our job is to find the truth, and the truth can be grey, and to write the uncertainty in, but that doesn't mean reporting everybody's opinions as equal. I think it's just about adding way more context and being like as independent as you can, and so following a process. So you're not coming at it thinking, okay, this is this is what I'm going to find, and I'm going to put it at the top, and it's actually saying, okay, this is the process that I'm going to find, and then I'm going to write what I think is true and what isn't. Sorry, that sounds really basic and trite, but.
Okay. Questions up here. Microphone, give up to you.
Hello. So my question's around the subscription model, which kind of works in a lot of industries, like the music industry. It's worked. There was talk around the elections of people being in their own bubble. Do you think if someone just gets a subscription to, let's say, The Guardian, that they'll be in their bubble and they won't get news from anywhere else then? And it will kind of feed into the issue of the bubble.
Who's that question for? Who wants to take that question?
Whoever thinks they're best
to answer. Jane, do you want to take that one? Just as an independent observer.
If you're just going to get a subscription to The Guardian, then you're probably... Well, actually, The Guardian is just asked for donations rather than subscriptions. But say it was a subscription... or you treat it as that, because when you put in your donation, then you're probably just quite like the person who used to actually buy The Guardian on the way to work or on the tube in the morning if you lived in London or whatever. So you'd still be getting your news from there. There would still be other types of free news. But I think in the future it probably will change. And I would imagine that within the next couple of years we're going to see much more of a kind of... iTunes, kind of Spotify for news, where people are going to put in, you know, the best of their own publications in, and you'll pay one overall subscription and be able to get it. So there's a few of them that have kind of started, but there's kind of problems with them. But I think that's where we'll actually see it going in the next few years.
I actually think a subscription to one particular newspaper, provided you read everything that's in that newspaper, you read through the op-eds, you read the editorial, you read the sport, you read the business... wouldn't actually be a bad thing. I think the problem now is that everyone is reading about the one topic or the one area they're interested in. I think that can often lead to people maybe having a great interest in perhaps politics, but not necessarily knowing about business or not necessarily knowing about farming. Whereas before, when you bought your newspaper, you got a bit of a variety. You might have come across a story that you didn't think you'd be interested in, but that you actually realise that actually there's something more I can learn here.
I think there probably is like a little bit of concern that if you have a subscriber model and you feel like, you know, the type of people your subscribers are, maybe even subconsciously you think, okay, I'm going to write about it in that kind of way, and maybe it's something to be aware of. But the fact is that if you have a subscriber model, you're reliant on, say, ideally thousands and thousands of people rather than on, you know, 6 or 7 big advertisers. So if you lose a few because they don't agree with everything you say, then it's not as big a deal. So maybe you don't have to be thinking as constantly about whether what you say is necessarily going to chime with absolutely with what they want, if that kind of makes sense. It's risk dispersed.
Just aware of time. So we get one question from the cluster up here, one question from over here, and one question in the front row. Okay. Gentleman there.
The question is really just about seeing behind the curtain. So we've talked a lot about verification and these models, and that increases trust in the reader. But is there any fear of showing people behind the curtain? Because it must piss off journalists that everybody with a camera phone thinks they're a journalist now. So is there any kind of trepidation about showing them what goes on, how a story comes to be, and how you verify it?
Very good question, but I think the answer is no.
The one exception is sources. And a lot of times sources have to be protected. So if it's a case of you're demanding to know the source of every story, that could make sources less inclined or more fearful about coming forward with important information. So outside of that, I would have no problem.
I think anonymous sources are way overused here as well, though. So I think the pressure to show behind the curtain can only be good for that. And there are some cool things that they've been doing in newsrooms in the US where they'll identify, say, okay, this person on Facebook keeps, you know, slagging us, or this person on Twitter. Let's invite them in. Let's have them spend a week in the newsroom where they can see exactly how we verify stuff, how we don't, how we do. And then it actually works for big organizations as well as smaller ones, because there's often a manageable number of people who are really, really disillusioned with what you're doing. So,
Like even for ourselves with Storyful, since we started, it was very much a let us show you what we're doing here. And there was an element of, you know, occasionally we think, well, if we show everyone, where's our business model there? And we've gone on to the next thing, and then we show them, and it helps everyone, I think. So yeah, I've never sensed that there's any fear of that.
I think someone had their hand up in the front row. Yeah, gentleman here.
You've been talking about mainly media things. If you widen it out and talk about specialist areas, and I'll give you an example. You may remember the Garda Ombudsman so-called bugging. We had to get a High Court or a Supreme Court judge to look at the evidence and conclude that there never was any evidence of bugging at all. Now, we got a judge to do that. It was the technology journalist had written that it was amazing that anyone could have taken the Veramus report on that seriously. It was so stupid if you knew the facts. Now, it wasn't just journalists who didn't pay any attention. TDs accepted a ridiculous thing, and the Irish technology journalists were saying in their own blogs, they can't be serious in taking this seriously. So my question is about that kind of specialist information.
Why didn't
anybody ask a technology journalist who were writing it? You just had to go on Google and you would have got it. I was puzzled by that.
That's a very good question, and I'm going to kind of wrap that question into another question, which is about experts. And, like, you know, the fact that, how are we seeing a decline in terms of, like, you know, as that gentleman says there, you knew the technology journalists were kind of debunking this straight away. Are we seeing a decline in terms of use of experts and kind of like a trust in experts? Who wants to take that one?
You're looking at me here. Yeah, absolutely. I worked on that story in an outside capacity. It was actually John Mooney from the Sunday Times, I think, broke it. And it was an interesting story to break. I think what more people were reporting on, in terms of my point of view, was actually reporting on the fact that there was a report saying that there was bugging, as opposed to saying that there was bugging. And I think we were always very careful in our language when referring to that. Now, you may have taken it up differently. I know in my reports that was certainly how we looked at it. There was always a question of doubt about that particular story, and I think it was debunked ultimately in the end. I do think experts play a huge role in this.
Instant, but not reported.
Well,
because
this is what you're saying. This is what you're saying. Now, there was a report saying that there was bugging.
Yeah.
This was looked at and it was being investigated. You were saying that someone had debunked it instantly, but it was still being investigated as a matter, you know. So, and that was how it was being reported. You know, it was important to let that process happen. And it was reported fully when it ultimately came out. I think experts are absolutely crucial in a newsroom, absolutely crucial. And I know in The Independent we have a lot of experts in the Irish Times as well. We're lucky enough to have them, and I hope that they are maintained, because they provide it's regularly I'll go to Shane Phelan, who's our court supporter, and ask him for something, I'll go to Paul Neely, who's our, basically he does a lot of the public affairs and the environment issues. I'll be running up the business day in, day out, and we need to use them as general news reporters throughout our reporting.
I just think we don't do ourselves any favours when we have so many opinion columns written not by experts. Like, it just completely undermines everything. And if we don't check opinion columns as well, or fact check them, like
That's a topic for banter at Dublin International Literary Festival next year, okay? I want to get two more questions. There's a person in the front row with a hand up. Is there a person? The man in the large jacket there, because he has his hand up a lot. So microphone to him, and then the guy in the front row as well.
Hi. So there's obviously been a lot of discussion about different ways that we can combat fake news, particularly education for readers, more investigation from the side of the media. But how do you feel about the amount of accountability that we actually force onto the contributors or the creators of fake news in the first place?
Kevin?
Yeah, I'm going to take that to begin with. That is an issue. And like it was, I think Lois mentioned earlier that we shouldn't blame the readers for not getting what we're trying to do, you know? But I do think that, like, by having readers as part of the discussion and saying, actually, you can help in verifying this, it does help. Because, like, yes, like, good reporting can debunk a news story, or can make sure that a news story doesn't go out that has disinformation in it. But when I did research into what's fake on Facebook, it wasn't necessarily always, you know, a link to an outside site. Sometimes it was just, you know, it's a meme of Hillary Clinton with just a completely outrageous piece of content there. And yes, some journalists will get to that and say, we've debunked this, here's the New York Times article about how, you know, that particular Hillary Clinton meme is false. But they're not going to get to everything. But having kind of a literate media people who are reading that and posting a link underneath it or sharing it or contacting their friend on Facebook and saying, by the way, that thing you shared, this is why I think, you know, it's bunkum. I think there's no harm in having that, but not washing your hands of it and saying, you know, it's all up to you guys on Facebook to debunk this yourself.
Yeah, I think it kind of depends on the motive. So, you know, if you're a Macedonian teenager who's making a few grand, like, what are you going to do? All you're going to do is, you know, Kevin is saying there, you know, debunk it and try to, whatever way you can. But if you're, you know, a huge American corporation that's actually deliberately targeting fake news at people in order to turn an election, then probably you should actually be accountable to the electoral standards authority in the country. So, you know, I think it kind of depends on how serious the fake news is, the extent to which you've targeted it, and what your purpose was. You know, so some people, yeah, you're just going to debunk, but others, I think we should actually hold them accountable in courts.
Okay.
Can I just inject another example? So in the wake of the Manchester attacks, there was a report that was released based on, I think, some sort of a tweet, which purported that there was actually a shooter outside a hospital or something near the arena. I don't know. I didn't see any reports about whether that particular source was, you know, even investigated, even by the police or something like that. Because, I mean, obviously that interferes with emergency services, for example. I suppose the original question was sort of focused around, in the more serious types of fake news, are we as a society and the media following up enough to make sure that while, you know, sources should be protected, in these specific cases, when they can be very detrimental?
Is that not an issue for law enforcement, though? Because, you know, if somebody is actually using fake news to incite to hatred, or somebody's using fake news to interfere with an ongoing investigation. Or, you know, these kind of things. These are current offences, and they would be up to the police force in Manchester or the Gardaí here or whoever to actually prosecute. So maybe, you know, there should be more prosecution of them, and then there might be less of them.
I'm kind of aware now we're really running out of time, so if you don't mind, just two questions. Thanks very much. One last question, because this gentleman here has his hand up for a long time. So.
Sure, yeah. I was just wondering, do you think the onus is on big tech companies like Google and Facebook to fund independent media platforms, especially when, you know, their revenue streams are responsible for a lot of the money disappearing from traditional media, and how do you think that would happen if they were on for it?
I think they should just pay their tax and then we should use some of that money to fund media, yeah. And if they won't pay their tax, then certainly it would be great if they had to have a fund that would support independent media of any sort.
Well, they've got the Google Digital News Initiative, which is putting you know, money into sort of digital tools all across Europe. So that's one step. I don't think it would be good for independent media to be dependent on these big places, though. I think it would be better to be dependent on readers, and yeah, it's more of a slog.
I keep seeing Facebook Facebook hiring journalists and hiring editors. I'm kind of wondering, have they drank the Kool-Aid?
No, I don't think they're doing enough, to be honest. I think they've made a huge amount of money from media without having to assume any of the responsibilities of a media organisation. Now, they are so big and kind of so all-consuming that you don't want them to kind of take over the role of media. But I think there are more ways they can help. Like they did react slightly belatedly to the fake news kind of panic, and they came up with like something of the start of a solution. Like you could flag something as fake, but there was then an example of a story actually getting a huge boost as a result of that, because right wing activists seized it as, this is the story people don't want you to see, rather than saying, oh, it's fake, let's stop sharing it. And so it actually did better as a result. So it's the start, but it would be interesting to see if Facebook are still willing to help, you know, in 5 years' time, maybe, when fake news is no longer kind of spoken about as this, is no longer the buzzword it is at the moment. I think they could do a lot more to help journalism, not to replace it, though.
Yeah. There's a symbiotic relationship to a certain extent with, like I said earlier on, Facebook takes a lot of our content, puts it up, and we're using back and forth. It'd be nice to see a greater revenue share from that point of view, but that's again going into a business model that probably don't want to discuss today. They absolutely have to do something about fake news, and they need to be as proactive, if not even more proactive, like Kevin says, about this, because it is eroding public confidence in media, and it is creating, like, we are getting a huge amount of the amount of times I've written stories that have been well researched or whatever, and someone just writes underneath of it fake news. It's quite disheartening. It's quite I'm not looking for people to feel sorry for me, but it is kind of it is feeding.
But we do have regulation of all sorts of media, you know, and yet for some reason we still go along with this notion that Facebook is a neutral platform and therefore it's outside of regulation. You know, probably Europe has to tackle that at some stage.
Okay, well, we're out of time, so it's a couple of thank yous. Thanks very much to Brendan on sound. Thanks very much to the volunteers here today. Big thanks to Joey and all at the International Literature Festival Dublin for the invitation. Huge round of applause, please, and thanks to Col, to Lois, to Jane and to Kevin. Thanks to Kevin, Lois, Jane and Col for joining us at Banter, and thanks to Joey Kavanagh and all of the International Literature Festival Dublin for the invitation and their help with this event. This podcast was recorded by Brendan Jenkinson, and the Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news or updated Banter, plus you can listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.